Good morning and welcome to this August 19th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on how to access those podcasts later in the hour. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone, back after a little summer hiatus. And what a fantastic way to step back in this morning. It's my pleasure to welcome debut novelist Julia Pierpont. And in the second half, Pulitzer Prize winning novelist and short story writer Adam Johnson will be on. Adam won the Pulitzer in 2013 for his incredible novel on North Korea, The Orphan Master's Son, and comes to us now with a short fiction collection, Fortune Smiles. But first, Julia is with me. Julia Pierpont is a graduate of the NYU Creative Writing Program, where she received a Rona Jaffe Foundation Graduate Fellowship, as well as a Stein Fellowship. Her novel is Among the 10,000 Things. It's published by Random House, and Julia joins us from New York this morning. Julia, hi.
Hi.
Good morning. Congratulations on the novel.
Thank you so much.
So for those people who haven't yet picked it up, I'm going to give you a chance to talk about it. Take us into this world. I love topics of marriage and infidelity and teenagers. And you covered all my favorite topics. So
oh, good. All the hits.
So, yeah, you covered all the hits. Exactly.
The novel opens with the delivery of a package from a young woman. It's addressed to the wife of the man with whom she's been having an affair. And it's just basically a box of evidence, printed out emails and chats and all the things that we sort of accumulate nowadays with technology being what it is and nothing being really erasable. And it's intercepted. It gets delivered by accident to the 11-year-old daughter of the family. And basically the fallout is what the story is about from there.
Right, right. I thought it was, you know, I mean, you could have all of these arguments about how much infidelity has been covered. And so finding a new way into sort of, you know, an old topic, I thought was really wonderful. And what a new way you found. So tell me a little bit about that process.
Sure. I think one thing that was really interesting to me was dealing specifically with how the children are affected and the ways in which parents are affected by how much their children know. You know, the things that we teach our kids are often not exactly the way we live our lives. Relationships are a lot more complicated than we teach our children or lead them to believe. And once the children know, suddenly the parents have to decide what kind of an example they're setting and how, and sort of measure how affected the kids are. So bringing them into the story from the beginning kind of changes the story of how the parents are going to behave.
Right, right. And knowing about an affair in an abstract, you know, the word affair way versus knowing all of the incredibly visceral details of the affair through, you know, email correspondence between the two and I don't know if email correspondence has been heightened because we will write things we wouldn't necessarily have written, you know, we'll write things in emails we wouldn't have necessarily written in the written word before through letters. I don't know if that's true or not, but, you know, it felt like the emails between them were much more graphic and visceral. And
yeah, there's something to writing things out, especially also if you factor in things like text messages or instant messages.
Right.
There are things that we probably wouldn't say out loud to each other that we end up saying to each other that way. And or if, even if it is, then there wouldn't be that trail of evidence at the very least. And that is a different thing. I mean, some of the novel includes some excerpts from their correspondence, and it is harsh. I mean, I knew it had to be hard to look at. You know, it had to be sort of extreme language and extreme just whatever would really cause the wife and children of this man pain to look at, even if they know in the abstract what's going on. It's another thing to really see the sentences spelled out.
And especially at that age, you know, where you have this preteen who's just coming to understand, I mean, doesn't even know what some of the words are and doesn't fully grasp the impact, but knows it's really bad. That's such a wonderful, I mean, as a fiction writer, such a wonderful age to put her at, to put her in the crossfire of this. That's wonderful.
Right. And there's this desire for the family, for the adults in the family to want to minimize the damage that she's feeling or try to make it not so bad for her. But at the same time, then you're maybe teaching her that these things are not a big deal, and then that becomes its own kind of confusion for her.
Right.
So you have to decide how much weight to allow her to feel or to give it.
Right, exactly. So you, I gather, so you're young. I'm going to out you on the air that you're 28.
Yeah.
And I think not married, right? And so you're
not married.
Not married. So your access to all of these characters and their reactions to a long-standing marriage and their kind of adult, very adult ways mm-hmm. and non-cliche ways of reacting to infidelity was really wonderful. So tell me a little bit about your research process, accessing mm-hmm. these people outside of your own experience and what that was like. Mm-hmm.
Well, my parents are married, so I've had about 28 years to observe them and how marriage seems to work in that way. I think, you know, even novels that are not at all autobiographical, the way we would describe them, have a lot of autobiography in them. There's a lot of myself in this, and a lot of what the characters go through are things that I've gone through. So I think you just sort of end up transposing the feelings. It's sort of dishonest to call a novel, you know, completely not autobiographical. Everything comes from you. So I can't cite specific examples in my life, and it's hard to express, like, how I decided that I could and should write about this subject. It was just a subject that I was drawn to, and it was sort of the lens through which I wanted to explore these other themes of betrayal and trust and miscommunication within a family, and this idea of time and lost time and what we lose.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Julia Pierpont. The novel is Among the 10,000 Things. Actually, you know, this might be a great time for you to read to us so the listeners get kind of access to your voice and access to the book a little bit before we delve into some of the craft questions.
Sure. Okay. The scene that I'm going to read to you, this is here we find Jack, the father of the family. He's a visual artist, and he has recently been caught cheating by his family, and he's been banished to his art studio. At the studio, Jack had a long leather couch. No shower, but a basin he could lean into and wash as far as his armpit. When a piece was going well, he was there all hours through the night. That had happened more often in the early years, when he was hungry and everything was on the rise. So many ideas, he'd only had to go out in the world, among the 10,000 things, and there they would be. He saw strange symmetry in everything. It felt like stealing. More recently, he had begun to ask why and what for, at least to wonder. He caught himself standing idle and oafish among the fuel tanks and torches, sharp dust crowding everything, unformed sheet metal. He was standing like that now. He walked to the big window and tipped it open as far as it would go, breathing in the mild midday air. No, he would not work. It would be against the grounds on which he'd married. Family was meant to make things easier. He'd seen other artists, rivals, and friends, how they struggled when they were alone, forgot to eat, lived in their studios, gave up their homes, or their homes became the studios. Jack had had it with the benders, had had his fill of them by age 40. The sad and unglamorous truth that he knew and other people didn't was that it's no good living like the art you're trying to make. Art is work. It is getting up early and working until you are tired and after, and it is surrounding yourself with things that keep you in a healthy state, people, life on a schedule. His first marriage had been screwed from the start, but now, with Deb, he'd married the right woman. He had. Marrying Deb, having the kids, all that was right. It was he who'd gone wrong, or the world. He'd felt it these last few years. Something to do with the internet and jihad and all the natural disasters they'd been having. There was a buzz in the air that made it harder to move forward, a feeling they were living in a time with no future. And then there had been that girl in her see-through blouses with the breasts under them, soft and pointed up like curious things. With her full lip and full ass, and how did she stay so full when everything else every day was being depleted? When, listen, look, it's not like I killed anybody. That was it. Jack did not really, in the end, believe he'd done anything so wrong. With the girl, he'd been careful to make no promises. Deb would need time and patience to forgive him, but here, alone with his tools, he could feel he was forgiving himself already. True, it was hard on the kids, but that was why he wanted to explain to them. Explain how much it was not about them. Maybe that was the painful part, that not everything in their parents' lives could be. The girl was a channel that let him be a better man at home, like a soldier, I do on the outside what I need to keep the inside safe. That was the truth of how he felt, something to be kept down deep and buried.
That's great. That was Julia Pierpont reading from her novel, Among the 10,000 Things. So writing from the male perspective, as you do, did the novel change your mind about anything as you were writing it? Did you feel like it worked out something for you? Did you feel like it made the situation all the more complicated, or did you come to some different conclusions about it?
Yeah, I had a lot of fun writing from Jack's perspective, Simon's as well. I think there's something liberating to write about it from a character's standpoint when the character has very little in common with you. It's fun to see their side and you end up empathizing with them. I think I get startled when I come across a reader who has very little empathy or sympathy for Jack's situation, just because I come to sort of understand all of their sides and really feel a lot for each of them. It is very, you do end up learning a lot, I think, about different people once you put yourself in their shoes, and it's fun. It's a lot more fun in a way to write than something that is like a character, a 28-year-old single female character. If I were to write about that, I mean, that's what I live every day. The last thing I want to do is go home and think more about it, you know?
Right. Yeah, I've talked to a lot of writers who have said that it is almost easier to access somebody who is completely different, like Nicole Krauss writing from, an 80-something-year-old man's perspective. She said was almost easier than writing from her own. I find that really interesting and true, probably. it's interesting.
Yeah, I wonder if it has anything to do with if there's something sort of self-censoring when you're writing a character that's similar to yourself, and it's sort of you're freer to explore sort of darker sides if you don't feel like you're writing about yourself.
Right, exactly. And your passage brings up the title of the book. The titles, I think, are incredibly tricky. And when I come across them in the book, I feel like I found the golden egg. talk a little bit about titling the novel, how you when that discovery was made and the resonance for you and, how it came about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I threw the title in that section, the title appears as almost kind of a wink. But originally I got the title from a poem by Galway Canal, who's a poet I've always loved, and the poem is called Little Sleep's Head Sprouting Hair in the Moonlight, and it's a beautiful poem from the voice of a father addressing his sort of infant daughter in her crib and imagining how life will go pass her by and how much he wants her to hang on to it and how he wishes he could hang on to it for her. And a lot of that, those themes were things I wanted to explore in the book, and it just is actually a title that I had from the very beginning, even before I kind of always expected them to make me change it. I sort of was always waiting for that conversation at some point during editing or the book production for them to say, now what this title we have to fix. but it just never came up, and so I guess I slipped by.
That's great.
With it, which made me happy.
I love the title. Yeah, I like the title.
Thank you.
So I'm going to be incredibly non-unique in mentioning the structure of this novel, and I don't think I'm giving anything away by this, but it's told in several parts. In the middle part, you kind of give away. The middle part is sort of the end, kind of a summary of what happened at the end. And then you go back in part three to tell us, exactly how the end was arrived at. So talk about that structure. It's incredibly unique. I thought it worked well. It's not a discovery of what happens now. It's a discovery of how it happened.
Right, yeah, and I think it was a little bit of a gamble. I hoped that people would respond to it and not go, wow, why am I still reading? Because that was kind of the idea behind it, is really wanting to, if you take away the question of what's going to happen, because in certain ways, everything ends, everything comes to an end, and just because we know that doesn't mean it's all for naught. We end up spending so much time wondering how things are going to turn out that we end up not sort of living in the moment or appreciating the day-to-day, and so by sort of pulling the rug out from under the characters and under the reader too in the second section and sort of zooming ahead in time and showing you what happens to all these people and then returning you to that present day, you kind of have to live with them in that place and understand what is the importance of it. Why am I still looking at this? And I wanted to make the reader wonder that a little bit.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the characters. We talked about writing from the male point of view, but let's talk about accessing the characters, how you made your way into these people, if there were some that gave you more trouble than others, and how you kind of dug through that process of fleshing them out.
Sure. Both of the teenage character, the preteen and teenage characters, I've at least lived through that time period myself, and it was sort of easier to channel them in a way, knowing them. I think maybe Deb was sort of the hardest character, the mother character, to channel, and I ended up sort of reading some different memoirs. Deb is a former ballet dancer, and I was I said ballet. It sounded a little bit like I said belly, I feel. But I ended up reading some memoirs of some former ballet dancers, and I was just very interested in giving her the kind of career that is so heavily weighted towards youth, and sort of how that, I just find everyone who is an athlete is such a fascinating career path to take. And I always wonder about that period of time when you kind of are no longer able to do it anymore, and how short a period window you have sort of to do it or not. So I ended up doing some research for her and also for Jack, because I wanted his art to be very believable, and sort of had to make up his art projects, and I wanted to find ones that seemed plausible, and I sort of ultimately had to trust people I know, who readers, to tell me if they thought that seemed like a plausible project or not. Mm-hmm. So there was some research in that way.
I'm now picturing Deb as a belly dancer, and it's rewriting the novel in my head.
Terrible.
Which is pretty good, actually. And Ruth and Deb's mom, rather, I thought was a really wonderful character, and it got me to thinking about minor characters and how much of their rich lives need to be on the page to understand that they're fully fleshed out characters, even though they have more of a minor role on the page. And, you know, if you struggle with that, of how much of their identity to include and, you know, kind of, you know, just to make them not flat and self-serving to the novel, they have to, you know, have their own interior lives.
Right. Their own thing going on, and you kind of have an idea of it's kind of that iceberg thing. During the editing of this, I ended up cutting out a whole sort of minor character from the third section. And it was, he's not very missed, I think, to read it. I think it was a good decision, but I miss him a little bit on a personal level because I felt like I'd known him a little bit. And it seemed like it was this great loss just because I had thought about him so much. But then once I lifted him out, the book worked better. So, my editor was right in that way, even though I think there was a lot more in my head than there was actually on the page about him.
Talk a little bit about the wonderful touchstones that you have throughout the book. We have, we talked about ballet and art. The Fountainhead plays a role. There's wonderful Seinfeld porn fan fiction. So talk about choosing kind of the right metaphor symbols for these characters to be operating around, and how those metaphor symbols serve the novel, and if that was sort of organic or intentional.
Yeah, you know, I think it is sort of organic, but it's one of those things that afterwards sort of look back and, you know, in hindsight, it seems to be kind of much more orchestrated than I think it really was for me. The Seinfeld thing, you know, I knew I wanted to give Kay, the daughter, some kind of creative outlet because she's a very shy, reserved type, and it's hard to otherwise access her thoughts and feelings because she's not really going to give them to you directly. So I came up with this idea of fan fiction, and then partly because I know Seinfeld pretty well, I felt like I could write that. And also because it's sort of not the typical choice for what I see typically when I looked on, you know, forums and message boards for fan fiction websites. Like, those are not usually the kind of stories that get adapted. That have, like, very devoted fans or cult followings. And so it just seemed like a funny kind of thing to do. And also, you know, those shows are on all the time. It is kind of the show that she would see probably twice a day or four times a day if she came home and watched TV after school.
Right.
So those are the kind of things that where if I look at it and I go, oh, well, Kay has Seinfeld and, you know, Simon has Ayn Rand. Like, it does seem much more deliberate now than it was when I was writing it. It sort of just kind of emerged that way. But they each have kind of their own little cultural mascot.
Right, right. Talk a little bit about your revision process through this and kind of what it looked like to put it together if you wrote it straight through and then went back and revised, particularly with the you know, interesting structural move in the center of the novel, kind of your process for revision and putting it together.
Mm-hmm. I know that I think I wrote it mostly chronologically. I know that probably part two was sort of being drafted and redrafted for most of the time I was writing the first and third parts, which were the sort of more chronological sections. And usually what I would do is, you know, there are sort of, the book is written in short chapters and really alternate perspective from between the four different main characters. And I wrote in the library, and I would just go at the NYU library, and I would just go in the morning on days or my writing days and sort of know, like, today is a Jack day or today is a Deb day, and that would just be what I was doing that day, is working on one of those chapters and just sort of committing to it in that way. And sometimes I would write, you know, there's a section where Jack goes off on his own and on a road trip, and it sort of spliced up with scenes from the other family members, but I wrote that all together because once I was sort of in his head and his momentum, it was easier to sort of just follow through with that.
Mm-hmm.
And get, you know, sort of, at that point I was reading a lot of sort of, you know, Dennis Johnson and things that I felt like were getting me more into Jack Swagger, and that was sort of that was that week or month or however long that I spent writing Jack's road trip.
Right. Tell me about knowing when you're done, you know, when it's ready to go off to the editor, you feel like it's the kind of best it can be, if you have readers that tell you it's time to let it go. I mean, I feel like I could hold on to a novel for 100 years. And
oh, I know. Except until you get so sick of it, you just are desperate for someone else to come in, because I think you get to a point where you know that there are problems, but you also don't know how to fix them.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that when I met my editor at Random House, the things that he told me he wanted to work on were exactly the things that I'd known were problems and I'd sort of hoped no one else would. Like, I'd sort of hoped he would not pick up on them, or no one would, and then maybe they would be too minuscule. But he immediately knew sort of what I'd had the hardest time working on, and that's sort of how I felt like we clicked and like it was right to work together. And I think at a certain point you are very eager for someone to come in and say this, and this. And then in terms of when I was really done, that was a lot up to him. You know, that was sort of, he was great in that he was like, we don't have to rush any of this. This is going to be done when it's done.
Nice.
So, but it meant, you know, a lot of revisions for a while.
Nice. Let's talk a little bit about MFAs. There's all this debate amongst the writer community if MFAs are necessary or useful. And it sounds like you had a wonderful experience at NYU and some really wonderful mentors. How necessary do you think the MFA is, and kind of what advice would you give people considering it?
I mean, I don't think anyone would say it's necessary. I actually one of the places I was really excited about the idea of going to was Irvine, and I even went so far as to take driving lessons before it sort of turned out that I was ending up going to stay in New York City and would not, in fact, need a license still. But I think I wasn't even really aware of MFAs. I wasn't even really aware I wanted to be a writer in college, as late as college, and then I sort of took a couple years off, and I was working little odd jobs and writing in my spare time, and I sort of became aware that these programs existed, especially if you can get, you know, a funded program. It's just an insane opportunity to sort of, it's basically like a writing retreat or like, and I think that if a writer has an opportunity to use it that way without putting themselves into some kind of financial strain, it can be really, really helpful. And I know, I understand that, you know, people talk about the dangers of kind of creating a homogenized class of writers, but I feel like everyone kind of came in with their own style and left with that same style. And it really, the main thing is it gave you the time to really work, and it sort of necessitated that you dedicate yourself to that and admit that that is the career path that you're you've chosen.
And you had the opportunity to work with Jonathan Safran Foer, which is, you know, fantastic.
Yeah, not bad either.
Not
sure.
Bad either. Was there, was there a great wisdom and advice that he gave you that you could pass on?
Yeah, he was so great. He was so great about just getting me to commit to the novel in the first place. I think it's so scary to write a first book. And he sort of just told me to just go with it. I was so worried that I was going to end up writing about the wrong thing. And he told me, you know, just start where you start. Any place is almost as good as any place else, you know, within reason. And you will find that the story goes where your interests lie. You will not accidentally write something that you don't care about. And that was just very liberating in terms of allowing me to commit to my initial sort of inciting incident and story idea that I wasn't sure was me.
Right.
Yeah, that was super helpful.
Will you approach it the same way the next time, or how will you go into the novel with sort of the same roadmap, or will you change your route based on what happened before?
Yeah, it's funny. I think once you are writing a second book, there is an awareness of not wanting to do too much the same as what you did before. Like, I think I probably will try to not have the same kind of family story that I had before, maybe try something a little bit different. But I like the idea of just sort of letting it come to you as you go. I'm not really big on outlines, at least not until I'm about halfway through, and then I have to figure out how I'm going to wrap it all up. But for the first part, I like the idea of just letting it kind of wander where it wants to wander.
Yeah. Is there something we should have talked about that we didn't? any advice, wisdom, mother stuff?
Gosh. Advice. You have to be okay. The other thing I think I learned was just from myself was you have to be okay with being alone a lot of the time and not wondering if that's a problem, and just knowing that if you're working on a book and you haven't talked to anyone all day, then you're probably doing it right.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's one of those things.
Right. How do we find you online?
I'm on Twitter at Julia Pierpont, and I have a Facebook author page as well. Oh, and I have a website, and which is just my name, juliapierpont.com.
Wonderful.
Just forget about the website.
I love it. Julia, thanks so much for taking the time this morning. This was great.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Adam Johnson will be on for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We will be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. We are on iTunes under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads. We're on Stitcher. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter, I hear, though I don't know anything about that. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Adam Johnson is the author of The Orphan Master's Son, winner of the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction, the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, the California Book Award, and finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. It was named one of the best books of the year by more than a dozen publications, including The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, The LA Times, and Entertainment Weekly. And my own list, it was my favorite book of 2013. Adam's other awards include a Guggenheim Fellowship, a Whiting Writers Award, a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, a Stegner Fellowship. He's a really good writer, let's just put it that way. He was also a finalist for the New York Public Library's Young Lions Award. His other previous books are Emporium, a short story collection, and the novel Parasites Like Us. But it's his latest collection, Fortune Smiles, published by Random House, that we'll be chatting about this morning. Adam teaches creative writing at Stanford. He lives in San Francisco and joins me from there this morning. Adam, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show, Marie.
Thanks for coming on. So interesting.
Beautiful San Francisco morning. There's fog going past my bay window, if I can set the scene.
You know, my husband's up there today, and he said, yeah, it's a typical, you know, winter summer in San Francisco. It's cold and all the things that you want from San Francisco. It's perfect. So I don't even know where to start with all of this, but I was going to say there's a wonderful short story in your collection called Interesting Facts. And so I had assembled a lot of interesting facts about you that I thought were sort of, insights into the way you approach the writing process. And one of those was that your dad, when you were a little boy, I read, used to be a night watchman in a zoo and would sort of take you behind the scenes with all those wonderful keys to see what the animals were doing after dark in the, you know, when they weren't on display, which sort of became sort of a metaphor for how you view the world and how you portray it in your fiction.
That's very true. You can maybe hear my coffee behind me. When I was a kid, my mother was working on her PhD, and to give her a few hours every night, my father would take me with him to the zoo when I was young. And like at sunset, he would go to work, and my mother would come pick me up around 9 or 10. And he had the keys to the Phoenix Zoo and would go underground and to where the enclosures were that the animals were kept at night. And it just taught me that there was a zoo that everyone saw, and then there was a different zoo, the real zoo. And that, I think it gave me a feeling for my whole life that you just had to lift the veil and find the animals lived, where they, but there was another place that you had to go to. And I always try to go there in my fiction.
Yeah. I also heard that you had this obsession with wandering the alleys in your neighborhood and opening all the trash dumpsters and seeing what people would throw away and trying to figure out, you know, what made the family tick. And I thought that, too, kind of came through in all of these short stories, came through in the novel, that you're, you know, digging in the digging in the dark to find people's secrets and find what makes them work.
Well, the notion that every little thing would be evidence to maybe build some kind of portrait or to arraign what a family is, you know, before the bar of contemporary life. I was obsessed with looking through people's trash. I didn't really take anything or do anything, but, you know, when my family got divorced, my parents got divorced, you know, I was maybe like 8 or 9, something like that. And I think to spare me the pain of things they hadn't told me, that they were having troubles. They never fought. And so the day came when I came home from school and there was a moving van that was already loaded. And so then, you know, my mom and I just got in it and drove away. And so I think it was, I would suggest it was worse to not know something was coming. But that, I felt like, you know, there was also another darkness, another trouble, like always brewing, that I was waiting for the shoe to drop, that anything wonderful could end at any moment. And I was always looking for signs that things were about to go bad.
Yeah, yeah. And I was thinking, there's this wonderful photo of you in your house in San Francisco, and the Wall Street Journal did a couple of photo shoots of you in your house. And I'm always interested in what writers collect. I was kind of looking at your cabinet of curiosities behind you.
Yeah.
And you have these, you know, birds and these glass, you know, china, I don't know, the walls are this rich green, and you've got, I don't know, all these wonderful collections of birds and owls and things. And I was wondering if there are things like that that you just find yourself drawn to over and over again, and sort of what you pull into your nest, your writerly nest to work on.
You know, when I was a kid, like before my folks split, my dad did work at the zoo, and this was the time before Craigslist, and he was the night watchman. One of his duties was to care for animals and maintain them all in certain ways. One of them was to keep people out of the zoo and out of the parking lots and, you know, drinking beer and doing things in the parking lots. But people back then, when they had an exotic pet they didn't know what to do with, they would often like abandon it at the gates of the zoo because they couldn't find other people who might want these things. And I thought, oh, the zoo will want this iguana. Well, the zoo will want this parrot. And so when we would go to the zoo, while we were in the zoo, often people would come up to the gates and leave gigantic snakes in buckets and terrariums. And my father never told the zoo about these things. He always took them home. And when I grew up, our house was filled with abandoned, strange pets. We had a fox. We had an alligator in a horse trough out back. We had tortoises. We must have had a dozen terrariums of snakes. We had a hawk in our house for a long time, which was a terrifying animal to me. But so we did grow up in this strange house of curiosity of animals. So I don't know. That always just seemed natural to me to be just over brimming with danger.
And your powers of observation, there's a wonderful story in this collection about Hurricane Katrina. Hurricane Anonymous is the title of the story. And you, I know you worked as a UPS man for a couple of days, gathering all of the wonderful, rich details that were included in that story. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your writer's eye when you sat down in Louisiana to do something like this, what you're keeping your eyes open for, what, you know, kind of where you draw your attention, what you're listening for in people's stories, kind of your research process from a, you know, what you're paying attention to.
Well, I did, you know, train as a journalist early on. I've always loved doing research, gathering information, especially interview. I've only written one story or one thing in my life that I didn't do a lot of research for. I love to gather real human stories to kind of use as a measurement for, like, the emotionality that I'm trying to achieve in my stories. But I had lived in Louisiana for a few years. I did graduate school there, and I loved that place. And when Hurricane Katrina hit, and then a worse, lesser-known Hurricane Rita hit a month later, it really kind of shocked me, and I wanted to go there and write about it. But, you know, our third child was imminent, and, you know, it wasn't a time I could do it. It took me 2 years to get there, and it was actually kind of nice because people had processed their stories a great deal. I wrote to UPS at the world headquarters in Atlanta. They sent me my brown uniform because their drivers had played a great role in being first responders to the hurricane. They kept delivering during both hurricanes. And so, you know, I went to Louisiana. I interviewed fishing game wardens, energy linemen, school teachers, the sheriff. What happened was, you know, when Hurricane Katrina was evacuated, they moved 30,000 people into the countryside of Louisiana, and they were hit less than a month later by Rita. And the idea of getting hit by two hurricanes was just irresistible to me. So I went and interviewed a lot of those people. And I also delivered 524 packages.
Oh, my gosh.
to figure out what it was like. But, you know, those drivers, they knew they had done this, you know, for 20 years. They knew what had happened to every family and every house. They felt intimately the narratives of that were disrupted of every family in the community. So they would say, oh, you got to go in that house. Ask him what happened to his dog. Or see this broken house? They moved here. We'd drive past a gas station. They'd see a car they recognized. They'd say, oh, go ask him about his sister. And I would jump out with my camera and my tape recorder and, of course, a package to deliver and just interview people all day.
So great. My guest this morning is Adam Johnson. The short story collection is Fortune Smiles. I realize that I've started the interview. I'm such an Adam Johnson fan that I sort of got excited and started the interview kind of in the middle of the interview rather than allowing you to talk a little bit about the collection and the things you were interested in depicting and how these stories came together and writing short stories in the aftermath of the novel. So talk a little bit about Fortune Smiles as a collection as a whole so listeners even know what I'm talking talking about here.
Sure, I'm happy to. Well, one thing I wanted to say is that you're right down there in Irvine. One of my first writing teachers was Ron Carlson, who directs the creative writing program at Irvine. And he's the one who made...
You're cutting out a little bit. We'll have to find you higher ground so your signal comes through a little better.
I'm sorry about that.
Okay. That's okay.
I think if there's one thing that kind of unifies my writing, it's that I just love hearing new voices and, you know, capturing narratives that you just don't normally see. If I was to write about an affair or something like that, I would just instead go read Richard Ford. You know, or if there was a marriage in trouble, I would probably just go read Ann Beatty. But, you know, there was something about North Korean voices that I'd never heard before and who had stories I couldn't find. Or I have a story in the short story collection about a Stasi officer, and I became interested in East Germany and in trying to find the story of someone who worked for that totalitarian regime. I couldn't find a single narrative, a single tell-all written by a Stasi officer. So, you know, I think I've just really become engaged in finding voices that we don't have out there. And those are exactly the voices that are most easily reached through fiction.
Right, right. Yeah, we were talking about this last night, that somebody was trying to write about fugitive women and how difficult it is to find their voices. And you're right, these absent people who are so inaccessible, kind of that's what reminded me of your zoo stories and your trash story, you know, of going through people's trash cans, is trying to find the most inaccessible. And what is more inaccessible than North Korea? I mean, it's, you know, the most misunderstood or the fewest amount of access. I'm not saying this very well, but the least amount of access that you could get to a society. I thought it was interesting. This weekend, the New York Times had a story about a North Korean woman who had defected to South Korea and was now trying to get back into North Korea, which was very resonant with one of the stories in this collection.
Well, you know, I wrote a novel called The Orphan Master's Son, and it's mostly set in North Korea, and the characters are North Korean, which made the feat a little higher. A lot of my students try to write what I call the Peace Corps story, which is an American goes out into the world, meets a different culture, and decides that they're awesome. And then the American has a great experience out there, is changed in some way, and then the American comes home. And I always tell my students, you know, if that American's so great, you know, if this other culture's so great, why is there an American at the center of the piece? So I always try to get that voice without an intermediary. And in my book, I think I suggested inadvertently that all one had to do is get out of North Korea to have a happy life, when I knew that it was just very difficult to transition from such a regime and such a world with circumscribed knowledge into South Korean society, which is one of the most modern on Earth. So I really wanted to use the benefit of a lot of interviews I did to create a portrait of two defectors who make it to the South, who struggled very greatly. And one of them wants to go back. He just cannot handle life with that much freedom and choice, and he doesn't know what makes these South Koreans tick. And in real life, North Koreans do redefect, and they do go back. It doesn't happen often, and it's difficult. But when you talk to them, there's an inherent nostalgia there, because they'll never hear their music again. They'll never talk to their neighbors. They'll never see their towns. They can't communicate. Everything they've ever known, every little school they went to or every little tree they would walk past, is forever inaccessible to them. Right. And I try to capture that strange position they're in.
Right. The interesting thing about the article that was written this weekend, the woman was acting as, she tried to pose as a spy so that South Korea would send her back, and they refused. That's not how South Korea treats their spies, so they won't send her back. She's in quite a quandary.
Yeah. Barbara Demick is a great writer who lives in L.A., and she is the, in terms of the world of journalism, is the great chronicler of North Korean refugees. She wrote a book called Nothing to Envy. It's one of my favorite books about North Korea. And in it, after interviewing defectors for, I don't know, 6 years, she came to the conclusion that that men have a difficult time transitioning. They often feel angry when they realize everything they've been taught is a lie. They were often not very adaptable to the new world. She said, but middle-aged women were the most successful defectors. They were fluid, they could handle change, they could embrace the South, and that, in her estimation, that women are the ones who are going to lead the new direction for North Korea in transition.
Interesting. Do you feel like you're done with North Korea, or maybe the better question is, do you feel like North Korea is done with you after the novel and the short story?
Well, you know, I wrote the novel. I was completely obsessed with it for a long time. I really came to care about the fate of North Korea, about the people who are trapped there, about their difficult transition. Interestingly, once I became known for the book, it was much easier to meet defectors. It was harder while I was writing the book, and I was like nobody. So I do come across defectors all the time. I have them write me, but one of the great things that has happened is that I think the success of a book about North Korea has let publishers know that narratives about North Korea are financially viable. And since my book came out 3 years ago, there's been a dozen great books about North Korea. Eight of them are memoirs written by North Koreans about their North Korean lives. And so, honestly, the greatest thing that's happened for my book is that the voices that I was looking for that I couldn't find are out there now. And I feel really wonderful about that. I'm writing a novel on a totally different topic, but you never know. If North Korea becomes free, I would love to jump on a transport plane and head over there and just begin talking to people and get the lives that the stories that these people have never been able to tell about their lives.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Adam Johnson. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2013 for The Orphan Master's Son. His latest collection is Fortune Smiles. The thing that really struck me about The Orphan Master's Son, and to a lesser extent in this collection, is I had to put The Orphan Master's Son down a lot because the events were so incredibly harsh, but the way you write about them were so incredibly lyrical and gorgeous, gorgeous prose. And you had said at some point it raises the eternal question of whether darkness deserves lyrical expression. And I feel like darkness can almost only tolerate it through lyrical expression. It's kind of what made that novel really work for me, whereas I might not have been able to take it in certain parts otherwise.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about it exactly that way.
Yeah, it's and the same was true in a lot of these stories. There were a lot of passages that are just so emotionally wrought, and yet the writing makes it, accessible, kind of emotionally accessible, where I feel like I would have shut down maybe otherwise.
Well, there are a lot of dark things in life that deserve our attention, and they're not easily gazed upon, and we don't normally go out of our way to go look at some of the troubles and strife that people have to go through in life. But if there's a book that engages you and connects you and slowly takes you to these places, I think it's much easier. What I have the hardest time reading are happy narratives, narratives in which, people are, successful and everything works out for them and they kind of thrum with good cheer. Because that's not necessarily the life I recognize. And I think that's the hardest story to write, is the happy story as opposed to the dark one.
Right, right. Lauren Groff wrote a very interesting review of this collection for the New York Times. She made a point that I'm still debating in my own head, which is that each of these six stories is so incredibly strong. But as a collection, there's something about them being together as a collection that not makes them lose impact, but the successive nature of one after the next makes each one not as strong as they would be if you just encountered them as solo pieces out in the world, that you somehow, become desensitized or something. And I was wondering if you could comment on that as short stories, individually versus the collection as a whole, and how you felt about this as a collection as a whole.
Really? That's a really strange thing to say.
Yeah, I know. That's why I read it and I was like, I don't know what to think about it. And I thought maybe you would know what to think about it.
Things like that are the reasons I don't read any reviews of my book. And I try not to read reviews of other people's books as well. But I guess the notion that, I worked, on these stories obsessively, trying to perfect each and every one of them. Each one delivers its own universe. I love world building such a great deal. Each one feels like a little novel to me. I think many of them could have been expanded into book length, but I compressed them down to have their kind of maximum coiled power. And maybe the notion that you need a few duds in there or flat stories to make the other ones shine seems ridiculous. I don't know that anyone would put a couple unpolished gems on a necklace to make the other diamonds shine. But one thing, I mean, a collection is your work, and each story has to be a gem, and I work to facet every aspect of them. That's a strange thing to say.
I think the way that I came away from it in the end, and the way that I read this collection, was I finished one, and then I put the collection down for 2 days, and then I'd pick it back up and read the next one. And I think that was her ending advice, was each one of these is amazing, so you should come upon it kind of fresh and not jump into the next one too quickly so that you can kind of digest what's happened to you each time.
Huh. I did kind of, even with a novel, sometimes I'll finish a novel and I'll like it, and then just before bed I'll be like, I've got 20 more minutes, I'll start another one. And I don't mind at all just transitioning into new characters and new worlds and just feed that narrative hungry mind of mine. And I don't know, it doesn't bother me at all.
Yeah, right. We're drawing down on our time, but I did want to ask about writing short, you know, the short story gets such an ugly stepsister. I'm a massive short story fan, by the way. I bring every short story writer I can find onto the show. So it's my favorite form. But in the publishing world, it seems to get short shrift. And I wanted to ask you about your feeling of the importance of short stories. And after winning a Pulitzer for a very expansive, long, immersive novel, it seems as though you must feel that the short story form still is important and vital, and you return to it. And just your final thoughts on that form.
Well, I absolutely adore the short story. It has a supercharged power that the novel just doesn't. A novel works through accumulation in a certain way. Having written two novels in a row over 10 years, I missed the story, and I couldn't wait to get back to them. And I spent just a couple of years just obsessing over these tales that I had been missing. And I honestly think we're in a renaissance of the short story. People like Laurie Moore and Kelly Link and George Saunders, and it's really a huge list. Juno Diaz are leading the way and indoctrinating us into the cult of the short story. And I think they are becoming commercially more viable. I read for the National Book Award last year. There were a dozen short story collections that blew me away. And a short story collection by Phil Klein won. His collection was called Redeployment, and they were about Iraq, and it captured that conflict better than any novel I had read on it.
Yep, I agree. Is there writing wisdom advice you can leave our writing audience with?
Well, I think if you want to create narratives that speak to other people, just do a lot of work, you know, do your homework. Research always inspires me. Talking to human beings always inspires me. You know, when you go out and interview someone who's been in a Stasi prison, or someone who has lost their home to a hurricane, or you interview a North Korean defector, suddenly your work is charged with purpose, and you have to live up to the story. You have to live up to what someone really went through in life. And to me, there's no higher charge.
Adam Johnson, I can't tell you how giddy I was for this interview, and you exceeded all my literary fantasy expectations. So this was really, really wonderful. Thank you so very much.
All the honors, all mine.
Adam Johnson is the author of The Orphan Master's Son, and his latest collection, Fortune Smiles, is out by Random House. It is wonderful. I suggest you drop everything and pick up a copy. You can find Adam all over online. He's got some amazing other interviews up and available, as this one will be shortly. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day. We'll see you next week.